a white Chevrolet Suburban. The gate guard instructed him to park at the back of Ferrante Escobar's fenced four-acre property and summoned Eleanor Dashwood, Jane, from the client lounge. Tio was maybe 30, the ideal height and weight to be a thoroughbred racing jockey. A white welt of scar tissue across his throat suggested an encounter in which his adversary had failed either to kill him or rob him of his voice. The man who would drive Tio back to Nogales, Arizona, followed in a Porsche 911 Turbo S. He parked near the motorhome with the engine running and the air conditioning on, and he never got out of the car. The repainted Allegro was a sparkly midnight blue, not a color in the Tiffin catalog. The company decorated their vehicles with bold, multicolor windstream stripes flaring along the flanks. Ricky had refined this motif so that there were fewer and smaller stripes of lower contrast with the base color, rendered in a single shade of high-gloss ruby red. The vehicle was so eye-catching that no one would imagine that it was on a clandestine mission. Carrying her tote bag, Jane followed Tio into the motorhome. Except for the windshield, the windows were tinted, and the vehicle carried a cargo of shadows. She and Tio settled into the dinette booth, facing each other across the table. She gave him the plastic-wrapped brick of money. 120K, as agreed. Tio put the cash in a tote bag of his own.
Enrique, he tells me don't check is it funny money, and don't do a count. He wants you should know he trusts you like no one else. You should trust him the same once you're over this widow thing.
Jane smiled. He's one hell of a romantic guy, my Ricky.
Yeah, all the ladies love him, and that's no shit. Plates on both vehicles, registration and proof of insurance in the consoles, special plates for the Suburban and the other stuff you wanted.
He gestured toward the rear of the motorhome.
It's all there in the bedroom.
Sliding out of the booth, she said, wait here.
You really gonna look it's all there?
I really am. When nervous, Tio fingered the scar on his throat.
I tell Ricky you don't take it on faith. It's gonna break the man's heart.
I'm sure it's all there, but before I'm in the middle of this business deal I'm setting up, I want to be certain I've got exactly what I need, that there's been no misunderstanding about what I asked Ricky for. Anyway, let's not tell him I had to do inventory. Spare him the heartbreak.
That's good with me. I hate to see the man sad.
He stopped fingering the scar.
You never know what crazy shit he's gonna do when he's sad.
When she returned from the bedroom, Jane said, everything's just as it should be. Tio gestured to the booth she had vacated.
Park yourself, and let me say some shit.
She sat, but said, I'm expecting my partners very soon.
I'll keep it quick. I want you should know some important truths about the man.
Ricky?
What other man we've been talking about?
Go on.
First, he's hung like a horse. Un enorme garañón.
Jane said, I'm willing to believe that, but how do you know?
I stood beside him at urinals 100 times. Understand, I don't look on purpose. I mean, I don't have no interest. But you take a piss with a guy often enough, you notice sooner or later.
Understood.
The first couple times with a new girl, maybe he goes off too quick. But after that, she's not so fresh to him, then he can last longer than any stud you ever knew. Twice as long.
And how would you know that?
Not saying I doubt you.
Tio held out his right hand so she could see the tattoo on the back. A red heart was enwrapped with a rippling blue ribbon on which red letters declared in Spanish, Maya owns Tio forever.
She's my girl.
She made you put her brand on you? He regarded Jane with an expression of pity.
Maybe you don't read guys too good. No bitch makes Tio do nothing. I did it myself for love.
That's very moving. Tio ducked his head, embarrassed by his sentimentality.
Maya. She was Ricky's best girl, but he moved on. So then me and Maya, we found this special thing together, like destiny or something. She's hotter than hot.
And that's how you know Ricky has staying power? Pillow talk between you and Maya? Tio shrugged.
You know how it goes. You get off together, it's so great, and then after, while you're laying there, you gotta talk about something.
He realized Jane might infer the wrong thing from what he'd said.
Just so you know, I'm a marathon guy in the sack, just like Ricky. Lo puedo hacer por horas.
I can tell just by looking at you, Jane said.
Yeah, but I'm not talking me here. I'm talking Enrique. What you need to know.
Jane felt as though she had been swept into the role of Roxanne in a grotesque parody of Cyrano de Bergerac, with Tio as a less than eloquent Cyrano, Enrique offstage as the even less verbally gifted Christiane de Neuvillette. Smiling, Tio put his hands together in prayer mode as if to suggest that God was witness to the truth of his words. Ricky, he never hit no bitch in his life. He never would hit no bitch. He treats them all like ladies.
If he ever hit me, Jane said, he'd have one less hand.
Tio's smile froze.
I'm just saying, Jane added.
Tio's prayerful hands separated, and he nervously fingered his scarred throat.
I don't see no reason to share that with Ricky.
Jane smiled and nodded. We don't want to make him sad. You just tell Ricky that I said nothing you told me about him was news to me. I've always admired him from a distance, first as a married woman with vows to respect, and now as a widow in mourning. When Jane rose to her feet, Tio said,
I also gotta tell how Ricky's crazy about music, you being a piano player and all.
Come along now. I've got work to do before I, like Roxanne, take myself off to a nunnery. As Jane was speaking, Tio got out of the booth with the tote full of money. When she got to the word nunnery, he flinched as if he'd been slapped.
No, usted no puede. You cannot. I tell you, Maya is hotter than hot, and you're so very hotter than her. This is a crazy thing for you. For my sister, yes, but never for you.
Of course, he did not get the reference and therefore did not get the joke, but Jane saw value in his lack of understanding, a way to keep Enrique at bay if she should need another vehicle from him in the future. With great solemnity, she said, If I survive this business I'm caught up in, considering all the violence to which I've been a party, I'll be most at peace if my in-laws raise my son and I withdraw from the world. There is an order at a monastery in Arizona, the Poor Clares of Perpetual Adoration. I believe I would be happy there. After all, Audrey Hepburn became a nun. Tio was doubly nonplussed.
Audrey who?
She was the most gorgeous movie star of her time, the Jennifer Lawrence of her day, but even more beautiful. And she became a nun, Sister Luke. She served the poor in the Congo, where she contracted tuberculosis. Jane neglected to add that this occurred in a movie, The Nun's Story. Clearly distressed, Tio said,
I am broken to hear you'll do this.
She squeezed his shoulder as if with affection and moved him toward the front door of the motorhome. Just be happy for me, Tio. Be happy for me and go back home to Maya. After all, you are hers forever. Chapter 15 Minette and Robert Butterworth were assigned to pay surprise visits to the homes of their students, who would now be in school. In the case of well-behaved and studious kids, Min and Bob would represent to the parents that the child was being evaluated as a possible recipient for a full college scholarship under a program sponsored by a wealthy philanthropist. As regarded ill-behaved or underperforming kids, the visit supposedly would be about evaluating them for possible placement in a program funded by a philanthropist who developed new high-tech methods of instruction for struggling students. While in the residence, they would be alert for any indication that something was not right. They had been provided with a list of clues that might indicate sympathy for Jane Hawke and the presence of her son. Min and Bob had memorized that list, though she couldn't recall exactly when she had studied it. If no one was home when they came calling, quite likely to be the case because most families needed two incomes these days, then she and Bob would enter and search the place. They had been provided with a police lock-release gun, a nifty device that could open any deadbolt. Two German shepherds had disappeared with the boy. Minette didn't understand why kidnappers would take dogs, or why the dogs would allow themselves to be taken, but that's the way it was. No point in puzzling over it. No point at all. Just accept the facts and move on. Do what you're told. Be useful. The dogs weren't dangerous. She and Bob didn't have to worry about being bitten. No need to worry at all. In fact, if they found two German shepherds that responded to the names Duke and Queenie, then the boy would be somewhere nearby. However, there was a chance that the kidnappers found the dogs to be too much trouble and killed them. Therefore, it was necessary to search outside each residence, too, for any signs that something had recently been buried on the property. Minette thought she would be nervous about entering other people's homes uninvited and poking around in their things, but at the second, fourth, and fifth of the first five houses, when no one answered the bell or knock, she breezed through those places with no sense that what she was doing might be improper or dangerous. After all, they were working with the authorities as part of a new citizens' support team for the police. They were doing the right thing. It wasn't dangerous, really. Heck, it wasn't dangerous at all. There was nothing to be concerned about. Nothing. Nothing at all. Besides, it felt so darn good to be useful. The fifth house belonged to Walter and Louise Attlee, parents of Minette's student Coulter Attlee. Coulter was a nice kid, good student, and Minette thought it unlikely that his mom and dad would be mixed up with kidnappers. But a little boy's life was in jeopardy, and it was like that nice African-American policeman, Deputy Kingman, had said, these days, you just couldn't be sure who anyone was or what they might do. You couldn't risk a little boy's life by giving a pass to people like Walter and Louise Attlee, just because you thought you could be sure they were good people. As Minette pored through the papers taken from the desk in Walter Attlee's study, a weird thing happened. Speaking in a stage whisper and yet bell clear, a man's angry voice spewed out a long stream of obscene and blasphemous words, dozens and dozens of them, like the ravings of a madman, as disgusting as they were meaningless. She had never heard anything so raw and vicious. The whisperer sounded as though he must be there in the study with her, but she was alone. When the voice fell silent after perhaps half a minute, Bob entered the study.
Min, what the hell? You hear that?
Yeah, I did. Someone's in the house.
No one's here but us.
The cursing resumed. Still a stage whisper, but louder than before. And Minette realized the voice wasn't in the study after all. It was in her head. The whispering room, she said. She'd never heard that term before, but she knew immediately what it meant, and it neither surprised nor frightened her. The whispering room allowed microwave communication between others like her and Bob, others who had been made useful. When you had something important to share in the whispering room, it went out to everyone else who had a whispering room within a radius of 20 miles, so they could be coordinated for a purpose and function well together. Functioning smoothly together was essential in this increasingly dysfunctional world. The whispering room was a tool that made a person more useful. Unfortunately, the angry and incoherent man grossly misused this wonderful new service, this internal Twitter system. Rather than communicating something helpful to others, he broadcast an insane vitriolic rant. And now, with the words came sharp attitude, fierce emotion. Minette could not only hear the sender's fury, but also feel it. His lust and bloodlust, carried on the words woven through the obscenities, so that she felt unclean and assaulted. Those vile words came in repetitious, rhythmic rushes, like some ferocious canticle, building in intensity, building and building until it had the power of a Gregorian chant. Suddenly, louder, more insistent, and Minette had no way to disconnect from it, his fury exploding into her head. Shaken, she sat in the office chair to wait out the onslaught, but soon needed to grip the desk with both hands as if it were a wave-tossed fragment of a sunken ship, her one desperate hope of staying above water on a storm-racked and rolling sea. The vulgar salvos of hate and threat grew in volume and velocity, became a constant cannonade of malevolent words twined with caustic emotions that were alien to her, emotions hot with cruel desire, but that howled through her like an arctic wind. In the progress of the storm, she realized that no longer were all the sounds in the sender's rant words, but now also shrieks and hisses and shrill cries like the keening of coyotes chasing down prey. And with this difference came a change in the nature of the emotions flooding into her whispering room. A new coarseness, a primitive, bludgeoning, shredding power that was both terrifying and alluring. The sender's transmission swelled into a fierce declaration of freedom from all obligations and all consequences, a celebration of the thrill of violent rape, killing, and the savage destruction of all that is the other. As this river of alien emotion sluiced through the channels of her brain, Minette became mildly apprehensive, as she felt something slowly eroding within her, as if this influx from the sender were a solvent. Near the door to the hallway, Bob had dropped to his knees and then fallen onto his side. He lay with his hands clasped to his head, but otherwise in the fetal position, with his back bent and knees drawn toward his chest, as though preparing to be born again. Minette lost all ability to judge the pace of the passage of time. Whether the invasion of her whispering room, and therefore her mind, lasted minutes or hours, she couldn't say. But the sense that something essential was eroding from her continued, although the disquiet that initially troubled her soon passed, and in its place arose an agreeable anticipation. Moments after her apprehension was rinsed from Minette, her Bobby came out of the fetal position, whereupon he did something unexpected and exciting.
Part 4. Whispering Armageddon. Chapter 1. Luther Tillman, four times elected sheriff of a mostly rural county in Minnesota, was tall and solidly built, yet he moved with cat-like quiet. When he opened the door of the motorhome and stepped inside, Jane knew at once that he'd arrived, not because the vehicle softly protested when it took his weight, but because the man had presence. She'd last seen him 12 days earlier, when he and his daughter Jolie had gone to ground in Texas with friends of hers, Leland and Nadine Sackett, entrepreneurs and now philanthropists, operators of the Sackett Home and School for Orphaned Children. At Jane's request, Leland had flown Luther to Palm Springs in the Sackett's Learjet this morning and had driven him to Indio in a rental car. Because he had been tied to Jane by the authorities and the press, he had shaved his head since she'd last seen him, and his face was beginning to disappear behind a flourishing salt-and-pepper beard. He had spent most of his life in uniforms and suits, a pillar of the community. Now he wore red sneakers, black jeans, a killer t-shirt featuring the face of the singer and actress Janelle Monáe, a loose black denim jacket cut to mid-thigh, the better to carry a concealed weapon, and a bling necklace of silver chain links. He looked like Dennis Haysbert might have looked in the role of a 50-something gang leader in The Hood, a godfather of street crime, if Haysbert had ever been given a chance to play such a character. Jane slid out of the dinette booth, where she'd been checking out various items she had purchased from her forged document source in Reseda, and got to her feet. "You're not as pretty as Janelle Monáe, but you look damn good to me." As they hugged each other, he said,
"I doubt I can kick ass like Janelle, but I'm ready to do my best."
They had been through a lot together in the 2 days between when they met in Iron Furnace, Kentucky, and parted in Texas. Jane not only trusted him with her own life, but with that of her child. He said,
"I don't know how you don't look tired. All you've been through."
"I'm tired enough," she said, "and scared. Travis is safe for the moment, hidden away. But they know he's somewhere in Borrego Valley, and if we don't get to him soon, these sons of bitches will." She led him to the dinette booth, and they sat facing each other across the table. Luther had picked up the trail of the Arcadian conspiracy when a friend of his, a schoolteacher named Cora Gunderson, had committed suicide in a flamboyant fashion, taking 46 other people with her, including a governor and congressman. He had not believed she was capable of such an atrocity. His reward for dogged and brilliant detective work had been the loss of his wife, Rebecca, and his oldest daughter, Twyla, who had been injected with control mechanisms and were now enslaved. His younger daughter, 17-year-old Jolie, remained in hiding with the Sacketts in Texas. "How did Jolie take it when you told her you were coming here?"
"Pretty much how a Marine wife like you takes bad news. Jolie doesn't swoon and get the vapors. She thinks I can single-handedly break these bastards, so she's all for us taking them down to get your boy. For such a smart girl, she has too much faith in me."
"Only what's been earned," Jane said. "You're not carrying any ID, are you?"
"No."
"Now you are." She slid a driver's license across the table. The photo was the one he had emailed to the house of the Dancing Gnomes in Reseda. "It's on file with the DMV in Sacramento," she said, "so it'll pass any police check. You are now Wilson Ellington from Burbank. The street address is real, and it's an apartment complex, but there's no apartment 25. They stop at 24.
"You know the best sources. Incredible quality," Luther said,
studying the hologram of the great seal of the state of California that appeared and disappeared as the license was viewed from different angles. "Maybe I've always belonged on the dark side of the law."
"In this topsy-turvy time, your side is the right side. I imagine you have a plan."
"I'll go over it with you. You ever fired an automatic assault shotgun?" He raised his eyebrows.
"I've never even seen one."
"You'll like it."
"What do we need it for?"
"Insurance. Just in case." Chapter 2. The rant was a river racing. Currents of words rippled through with wordless expressions of rage and need and hatred, a tireless primal scream as nuanced as nature herself, a corrosive, erosive flood tide surging through Minette, so loud now that no sound in the world around her could compete. Such a great volume poured into her, and nothing poured out, for she had been struck dumb by the power of this tsunami of sound and primitive emotion. She sat behind the desk, with her mouth agape, but issuing only silence. To make room for the incoming dark deluge, structures within her dissolved. The fear evoked by the assault faded. A tentative excitement rose in her, and soon grew into a thrill born from a sense of wild possibilities, feral freedom. Bobby, her man. He let go, let loose, went for it, tore a picture off the wall and smashed it repeatedly against an armchair, glass shattering flying, frame splintering. He dropped the ruined picture and picked up the chair, the big chair. Such strength, such power, and threw it, just threw the chair into a freestanding set of bookshelves, and the shelves toppled and the books spilled across the floor. He snatched up a book and tore it apart and threw it away and snatched up another, ripped off the dust jacket, ripped off the boards, ripped with the animal glee of a predator rending its prey. His face wrenched with rage, yet she thought he might be laughing, delighting in both his fury and the destruction. She understood. She did. How all this clutter of humanity could infuriate, the way they lived, their pretension, so many things all around, too many things. The voice screaming in her whispering room was calling her to something better, to something pure, calling her to break free of this humdrum existence, to shuck off the bonds of bullshit civilization, admit to her true essence, which was animal, to stop striving for the sake of striving, to cast off the burden that millions of years of change had layered on her kind until it crushed her animal spirit. He, the man, he ripped the shade off a floor lamp, picked the lamp up by its pole, swung it like a hammer, the heavy base smashing several porcelain figures, ladies in fine gowns. It was so exciting to see the fancy bitches' hands torn from their glossy arms from their bodies, exhilarating to see their bodies shattered and headless on the floor. The man, sweating and red-faced and so powerful. She couldn't remember his name. Her own name eluded her. Didn't matter. Any name was a burden, like a brand on cattle, the hateful slave mark society burned onto you. He looked at her. The man, the male, he looked. She could feel his wild delight, joy, rapture in throwing off all restraints. There was a thing on the desk before her. The word computer passed through her mind, but meant nothing to her. And she picked it up, raised it high, threw it. Tethered to the wall by cords of some kind, it took brief flight, came to a sudden stop in midair, and ripped free of the wall with a spurt of sparks. It crashed to the floor, and the sound of the impact shivered through her, untying knots that she'd never known existed. She began to come loose and free. Chapter 3. Egon Gottfried checks into a hotel in Beaumont to take time to discern what the script expects of him. The hotel is so lacking in character that he feels as though he has taken a room in the mere concept of a hotel, which, given his radical philosophical nihilism, is exactly what he's done. Nevertheless, because food and drink have taste and effect, even if they are unreal, he goes downstairs for lunch, to have a sandwich and a drink or two at the hotel bar. A pressed copper ceiling, walls and floor and booths and tables and chairs of dark wood and red vinyl upholstery are reflected in a long back bar mirror, so the place seems immense and even lonelier than it is. The bartender is a tall guy with big hair and a bigger gut. But with a cold stare and a grim expression, Gottfried turns the man from a hearty Texas howdy type into a quiet, efficient server. He is sipping his second scotch when his bacon cheeseburger is served, and he's two bites into the sandwich when a fussy-looking professorial type sits at the bar with one stool between them. This obvious walk-on character has unkempt white hair and white eyebrows that haven't been trimmed since the turn of the millennium. He's wearing a black onyx stud in one ear, wire-rimmed half-lens glasses, a bow tie, a plaid shirt, a classic tweed sport coat, brown wool pants, and white athletic socks with moccasin-style loafers. The man is so detailed and so not Texan that Gottfried realizes the unknown playwright is using the professor as an avatar, stepping into the play to deliver a message that must not be ignored. The professor orders the same scotch that Gottfried is drinking, which is another sign of his importance to the story. While the man waits for his drink, he opens a thick paperback and sits reading, as if unaware that another customer watches from one stool removed. Gottfried understands the playwright's narrative structure well enough to know that the book matters. In fact, it seems to glow in the faux professor's hands. In The Garden of Beasts by Eric Larson. Judging by the cover, it's a work of nonfiction set in Nazi Germany. Gottfried finishes half his burger before he says, "Good book." Pretending to be surprised that anyone shares the bar with him, The professor pulls his reading glasses farther down his nose and peers over them at Gottfried.
It's brilliant, actually. A chilling depiction of an entire society descending from normalcy into almost universal madness in just a year or so. I feel a disturbing parallel to our own times and that long-ago Nazi ascendancy.
Gottfried says, the National Socialist German Workers' Party, Hitler and that ragtag crew around him, they seemed to be such a bunch of clowns, though I guess they couldn't have been just that. This observation inspires a sense of intellectual brotherhood in the professor. He swivels on his bar stool to more directly face Gottfried, puts aside the book, and grips his scotch glass in an age-spotted fist.
They were precisely what you say. A cabal of clowns, foolish misfits and geeks and thugs, pretenders to philosophical depth, ignorant know-nothings who fancied themselves intellectuals.
Gottfried nods thoughtfully. Yet they led an entire nation into a war and genocide that killed tens of millions.
Our own time, sir, is infested with their ilk.
But how? Gottfried wonders. How could they so easily lead a rational nation into ruin?
Yes, how? Look at them. Goering had a soft baby face. Horst Wessel was a chinless wonder. Had he been an actor, Martin Bormann would have been typecast as a gangster. Himmler, a sexless nebbish. Hess really looked like a Neanderthal. But they understood the power of symbols. Swastika, Nazi flag, the power of rituals and costumes. Those Nazi uniforms, the SS especially. Hitler in trench coats and battle jackets. A bunch of dish rags made glamorous with costumes. They were pretenders, actors assigning to themselves leadership roles and giving stellar performances for a while. Beware actors who can become anyone they wish to be. They are, in fact, no one at all, cold and empty, though they can be Pied Pipers to the masses.
The professor drains his scotch. The bartender delivers a fresh glass of whiskey even as his customer finishes the first. Thinking about Vince Penn and Rupert Baldwin and Janice Dern and so many others, Gottfried says, but for a conspiracy of clowns to take power and crush all adversaries, they must have something more than an understanding of symbols, rituals, and costumes.
Passion, the professor declares. They had more passion than those who resisted them. A passion to rule, to tear down society and remake it more to their liking. A passion to silence all dissent and to make a world in which they wouldn't have to hear an opinion at variance with their own. The passion for destruction always has more appeal to more people than does the passion to preserve and build. It's an ugly truth of human nature. Passion, sir. The kind of raw passion that breeds ruthlessness.
Gottfried nods. They so believed in the rightness of their cause that they could kill without compunction. If you can kill without remorse, then you can slaughter your way to absolute power.
Sad to say, but yes.
If you want to be a leader, Gottfried continues, embrace the role. Don't just go along for the ride. Symbols, costumes, glamour, and passion can make even clowns appear to be godlike. The least likely among us can triumph.
How true, says the professor. How dismal, but how true.
Although his companion has not finished the second scotch, Egon Gottfried says, I was depressed when I sat down here. But you have so lifted my spirits that I want to buy you a drink, if I may.
Sir, I never decline the kindness of strangers, but how peculiar that such a dark subject should lift your spirits.
Not at all, says Egon Gottfried. You have helped me with a personal dilemma, and I am in your debt. Chapter 4. Wearing white sneakers, breezy-cut white chinos, and a bright pink and blue Hawaiian shirt with a flamingo pattern, 81-year-old Bernie Rigowitz stood 5'7", weighed at most 140 pounds, and didn't look like anyone's image of ideal backup in a crisis. A little over a week earlier, urgently in need of new wheels, Jane had forced Bernie at gunpoint to give her a ride in his Mercedes E350 from middle-of-nowhere Texas all the way to Nogales, Arizona. He had proved not only to have the right stuff, but also to be the right stuff. Unflappable, quick-witted, and game. Somehow, the kidnapping had turned into an agreeable road trip, at the end of which they were mishpucha. Now in the Tiffin Allegro, Bernie sat in a dinette booth with Jane across the table from Luther Tillman, listening to their story of techno-Arcadians and injectable, brain-tropic, self-assembling nanoparticle control mechanisms. He exhibited none of the amazement or fear that might be expected. He asked no questions. His face revealed nothing of his thoughts, and although he listened intently, there was a faraway look in his eyes. Concerned that she couldn't read his reaction, Jane said, "Bernie, what's wrong? It sounds too cockamamie or something?"
"Dear, you should excuse the expression, but it sounds so not cockamamie that my kishkas turned to jelly."
"Listen, if you feel this is more than you bargained for, if you want to back out..." Putting a hand on her arm, Bernie said,
"Darling, stop already. You should live so long that I'd have a back out on you."
To Luther, he said,
"I am so sorry about your wife and daughter. The pain."
He grimaced in sympathy and could say no more. Luther loomed across the table like a version of Thor, and there was a rumble as of distant thunder in his voice.
"We're not going to let the bastards take Travis from Jane. Your lips to God's ear."
Bernie squeezed Jane's arm.
"I don't put much stock in the Kabbalah, but I'm told in Sefer Yetzirah it says something about making a golem from clay and using it for vengeance. What these Arcadian momsers are doing is a reverse golem. They take precious human beings and mold them into obedient clay. It's not possible to back away from this and still have any self-respect. So when do I get a gun?"
"You won't need one," Jane said.
"Maybe I will. I know from guns. Back in the day, the Whig business was not all bagels and cream cheese."
To Luther, Jane said, "Bernie and his wife owned a wig company, Elegant Weave. They sold wigs up and down the eastern seaboard."
14 states and D.C., Bernie said. "It was mostly a city business, so there were the usual wise guys wanted their cut. Better you should declare bankruptcy the day you open your doors. We didn't give them bupkis. I had a gun, Miriam too. We could make hard-boiled like Bogart and Bacall when we had to convince the Khazars we were tough."
He turned his hands, palms up.
"I'm embarrassed to admit, Sheriff, our guns weren't legal, but we never did shoot anybody."
Jane stared at Bernie in silence for a moment. "You think you know someone, then you find out he's a tough guy."
"That was a long time ago. I'm 81 now. I'm about as tough as a cheese kreplach."
Luther said,
"God knows what we're going into. You should have a gun, Mr. Rigowitz. You cool with that, Jane?"
"How long has it been since you fired one?" she asked Bernie.
"About 3 weeks. Wherever I am, I find a shooting range once a month and do some target practice."
"You mean you have a gun?"
"An old man who likes to drive mostly at night and through some lonely, wide-open spaces? He shouldn't have a gun. It's there in my suitcase. I just wanted to feel you out. Did you think me having a gun was kosher?"
She said, "The night in Texas I jacked your car, you had a gun then?" He smiled and nodded.
"In a special holder, under the driver's seat, muzzle backward, grip forward, so I could just reach under and snap open the sleeve and have it in hand."
"Why didn't you pull it on me?" He looked aghast.
"Pull a pistol on a girl as pretty as you? Enough already."
"They call me a monster. What if I had been?
Bubbler. I needed about a minute to know your heart is maybe half your body weight. Am I right, Sheriff?
Never more so, Mr. Rigowitz. And call me Luther.
Mr. Rigowitz was my father. Call me Bernie.
Luther's smile was the first that Jane had seen since he'd boarded the motorhome. He said,
"We have a dream team here."
She put an arm around Bernie and kissed his cheek and said, "Okay, Elliot Ness. You drive the motorhome, sneak Luther and me into Borrego Valley, then be ready to sneak us out. If you need the gun, use it. But if you have to start shooting, it'll mean we're over the cliff." Chapter 5. She raged with her mate through the house, overturning, tearing, smashing, driven by the rapid rant inside her head, a fierce voice in a language half remembered both by the unknown raver and she who received his tirade. Not just words, but also hatreds that were not her own, but became hers too upon receipt. Vivid images were transmitted into her mind's eye from elsewhere. Enormous overhead blades whisking the wind, a savagely bitten, eyeless face, a cleaver raised in a clenched fist, again the huge blades whirling faster, faster, flashing with reflections of silvery sunshine, a human head rolling as if toward an array of tenpins, dolphins leaping on a lampshade, storm-tossed ships hung on a wall, a burst of fragile bones and feathers as a winging bird encounters the bright spinning blades and disintegrates like a clay target shotgunned from the sky. Those continuing visions thrilled her as she wrenched open the door of a display cabinet with enough force to tear it from its hinges. She flung the cabinet door, and the misshapen discus clattered against a wall with a shattering of glass. Within the cabinet were cups and saucers, plates and bowls. From a shelf, she scooped up gold-rimmed china chargers and threw the stack onto the dining table. She grabbed a gravy boat in her left hand, a small cream pitcher in her right, and smashed them together as if they were a pair of cymbals. As the porcelain disintegrated, she cut the ball of her thumb. Blood welled, and with something like vampiric need, she put her mouth to the cut, sucked, and drank of herself. Having seen this, her mate relented in his rampage and took her hand and brought it to his mouth and sampled the essence of her. The taste inflamed in them a fierce desire, a rutting frenzy, which the ranting voice in her head encouraged, so that she found herself upon a table from which most of the broken china had been swept away, half their clothes somehow gone, and he upon her. They rocked the table with carnal rhythm, copulation without tenderness or love, so ferocious that it was both thrilling and terrifying. They were incapable of language, their animal voices resounding from the walls of the ravaged room. At the peak of her excitement, an image came into her mind's eye that was not from the ranting other, that arose from her own experience, a remnant of her faded memory. A dead woman, slouched in a wheelchair, her once pretty face grossly distorted. With that memory, a dark wave of grief washed through her, and in the throes of coitus, she suddenly spoke. I am Minette. But she could not sustain the grief, nor the memory. In the wake of the grief rose a tide of rage that swept away the name forever, and with the name went the last of her memories, all human purpose, all hope, all promise of transcendence. The meal finished and rolled off her, off the dining table, stood sweating and swaying and satiated. Among the few shards of broken china still on the table, she gripped a pointed, sharp-edged chunk of porcelainware and, with pleasure greater than that of copulation, used it to attack and kill the male. Chapter 6. As Carter Jurgen and Radley Dubose cruise the town of Borrego Springs, alert for telltale stains on the fabric of normalcy that might be a clue to the whereabouts of the Hawk Boy, many pedestrians do a double take at the sight of the formidable black velociraptor. Jurgen reads envy in the faces of many of the men, who would no doubt forfeit a year of their stunted desert lives to drive such a thrilling vehicle. He knows how they feel. A sphinx in sunglasses, his stony face carved by solemnity, DuBose says,
I don't like what I'm feeling.
Then keep your hand off your crotch, Jurgen replies.
This is no time for frivolity, my friend. I possess a highly developed intuition, almost a sixth sense, if you will, especially regarding trouble pending. At this very moment, I feel something portentous imminent, something momentous and ominous. I can feel it in the ether, see it in the slant of sunlight, smell it in the dry desert air.
In Carter Jurgen's mind, the hills of West Virginia, from which DuBose hails, are populated with rustic soothsayers and grizzled old men who, with a forked stick, can divine what they claim is the best place to drill for water. Toothless old women who call themselves heruspices and foretell the future from the entrails of slaughtered animals, Bible-thumping prophets of apocalypse, and other backwoods Cassandras in great variety. Growing up among such occult-oriented hayseeds, Radley DuBose's mind, such as it is, must be woven through with so many threads of superstition that the dons of Princeton had no chance of instilling in him the secular superstitions that they prefer. So, will it be a plague of locusts, frogs, flies, boils? Jurgen asks. After a thoughtful silence, DuBose says,
It's something about Ramsey Corrigan.
The one in 10,000. Reptile consciousness. What about him?
Something.
So you said.
We overlooked something.
Something?
Yeah. Something.
DuBose pulls to the curb and stops. As still as stone, the beefy, lion-bodied man stares through his wraparound shades, through the tinted windshield, gazing at the Anza Borrego wasteland as if it's an Egyptian desert in which some ancient truth lies buried in a sea of sand. After a minute, Jurgen says, Okay if I turn on some music? Just then, a siren wails. A county sheriff's patrol car turns the corner ahead, its light bar flashing, and accelerates, heading south. DuBose pulls the steering wheel hard to the left, arcs across two lanes, and follows the black and white, riding its tail as if it's a police escort sent specifically for him.
This is it, he says.
This is what?
The something.
How can you know that? Jurgen asks. With evident pity, DuBose says,
How can you not know, my friend? How can you not?
Chapter 7 The low barrens, a wilderness of sand, where in summer there will be no surcease from heat, as there sometimes can be in high deserts, the sun already merciless here on the brink of spring, quivery thermals rising from the blacktop like spirits liberated from graves beneath the pavement. Out of Indio, cruising south on State Highway 86, boosted on his donut-shaped prostate-friendly foam pillow, Bernie Rigowitz handled the big motorhome with confidence. Sitting high above the roadway seemed to empower him. When other motorists displeased him, he expressed his frustration colorfully.
Look at that schmo, going 20 miles over the limit. From the way he drives, a person could think he wears his buttocks for earmuffs.
In the co-pilot's seat beside him, Jane said, 27 more miles to Salton City, then west on County Highway 22 for about 30 miles. Behind Jane, in the freestanding Euro recliner between her seat and the door, Luther said,
I'm looking at the sofa. You sure it's the right fit?
I wouldn't want to spend the night there, but maybe it'll get me through a roadblock if there is one. Another speeder, faster than the first, inspired Bernie to say,
That schmo shouldn't wreck himself and wind up with wheels for legs, but it'll be a regular miracle if he doesn't.
Jane felt safe with Bernie at the wheel and Luther at her back, but the world beyond the windshield seemed more hostile than ever. The Salton Sea came into view on the left, a reminder that the land on this side of the Santa Rosa Mountains was depressed, the water surface more than 200 feet below sea level. The sun made quicksilver of the salt water, which glimmered less like a mirror than like some toxic lake in a dream peopled by drowning victims who, breathless and salt-blinded, swam forever through the depths, searching for living swimmers to drag down and suffocate. Chapter 8. The two-story clapboard house is surrounded by a mantle of real grass, shaded by four tall, flourishing phoenix palms. The property must have a deep-drilled well that allows the owners to pretend that they are living in a more hospitable climate than is the case. A Buick Encore is parked alongside the road, 20 feet short of the driveway and north of the house. The Sheriff's Department Dodge Charger passes the Buick and parks just the other side of the entrance to the property, directly in front of the residence. DuBose turns boldly between those vehicles, into the driveway, past a mailbox surmounted by a plaque bearing the name Atlee. As he sets the brake and switches off the engine, he says,
"Do you smell the something now, my friend? Do you smell it? See it? Feel it in the very air?"
"Smell, see, feel what?"
"Looming crisis," says DuBose, and gets out of the Velociraptor.
Jurgen is relieved to see that the two sheriff's deputies were among those at the market on Sunday, following the shooting of Gavin and Jessica Washington. They know Jurgen and DuBose carry National Security Agency credentials. The locals forfeited jurisdiction on the Washington killings, superseded by federal authorities, and they are likely to relent without argument in this case as well, if that's what DuBose wants.
"That's Mrs. Atlee," one of the deputies says. "Louise Atlee,"
as a 40-ish woman gets out of the Buick and approaches them.
"She called 911 to report a 460.
"Burglary?"
DuBose says.
"Yes, sir."
Agitated and distressed, Mrs. Atlee arrives. "Thank the Lord you're here. Something's gotta be done. I'm afraid maybe it's too late, but something's gotta be done. I turn in the driveway. A living room window shatters, just shatters, and... Her mouth softens, her lips tremble, tears brim in her eyes. "And then my beautiful, beloved Wilkinson long case is heaved into the yard like garbage to be hauled away. It was horrible, horrible."
"Who is Wilkinson long case?"
one of the deputies asks, his right hand resting on the grip of his service revolver now that burglary seems to have escalated to murder.
"It's not a who," DuBose informs him. "It's a what. A George III long case clock, what you might call a grandfather clock, made by Thomas Wilkinson, mid to late 18th century.
With mixed emotions, none of them good, Carter Jurgen regards his partner, the heretofore unrevealed antique clock expert. Jurgen is glad he wasn't the one to ask who Wilkinson long case was. Mrs. Atlee says, "My one antique, handed down through 5 generations, and now probably wrecked beyond repair." She extends one arm, one trembling finger, and Jurgen looks where she points. The long case lies on a side yard, canted against the bole of a phoenix palm. "The clock crashes through the window, so I back fast out of the driveway, park along the road, call 911. I get out of the car. There's this hellacious noise, just hellacious, inside my pretty little house, like someone smashing everything in my house." Tears spill down her cheeks. "They're shouting, too, cursing, 2 voices, a man and a woman. So I get back in my car, keep the engine running, ready to go. But then you're here, and now it's quiet, all quiet in there. Whoever it was, they must have escaped out the back." The concern that the perpetrators have fled the scene is at once allayed when the front door of the house opens and a naked woman steps onto the porch. Her hair is a wild, tangled mane. Her hands appear to be gloved in blood. She is Minette Butterworth, one of the adjusted people, whose wheelchair-bound sister DuBose shot 3 times the previous night. Chapter 9. Thunder avalanches down the sky, shuddering the bones of the hotel in Beaumont, and shatters of rain break against the windows, near one of which Egon Gottfried sits at a small table in the living room of his suite, working on the late Rupert Baldwin's laptop. He begins with a list of names. Jim Lee Cassidy, the realtor in Killeen, who saw Ansel and Claire Hawk heading on foot toward the bus station. Sue Ann McMaster, the clerk at the bus station who ticketed them through to Houston. Lonnie John Bricker, the driver behind the wheel of the bus from Killeen to Houston. Tucker Tredmont, the discourteous Uber driver in Beaumont, who for $121.50 led them to an isolated rural property containing an abandoned house, reeking chicken coop, and ramshackle barn. The one name Gottfried needs and doesn't have is that of the bus station manager in Beaumont, such a nondescript character in an obvious walk-on role that, at the time, there seemed to be no reason to remember her. Using the NSA's bottomless data troves and backdoor connections to thousands of government and private industry computer systems nationwide, he requires 6 minutes to discover that the station manager's name is Mary Lou Spencer. Assuming that Ansel and Claire Hawk indeed borrowed the Mercury Mountaineer belonging to the Longrins, and assuming that, in fact, they drove it to Killeen, where they abandoned it, the question then becomes, did they really go from Killeen to Houston? The unknown playwright has thrown Gottfried into a puzzle pit, and if he doesn't figure his way out of it, there is inevitably going to be pain. Gottfried is as sure as he can be about anything that the portly Tucker Tredmont, with his pointy-toed boots and man-breasts and calculating greenish-gray eyes, never took the Hawks anywhere, let alone to that rotting house, stinking chicken coop, and tumble-down barn. The easiest course of action is to track down Tredmont and torture the truth out of him. But that might be a mistake. If it's expected he will take such action, he could be walking into a trap. The unknown playwright wants him to be an iconic loner and a violent force, but the UP also doesn't want anything to be easy for Gottfried. Otherwise, he wouldn't have been sent chasing across half of Texas. Apocalyptic, multi-figured bolts of lightning flare and flare over Beaumont, as if some giant, otherworldly spider is skittering through the city on white-hot electric legs. Runnels of rain on the window glass quiver with mercurial reflections. Egon Gottfried starts with Jim Lee Cassidy, the white-haired realtor in Killeen, and rapidly builds a profile. Cassidy is 66, born in Waco, Texas, served 20 years in the Army before retiring and taking up a career in real estate at the age of 39. Married to Bonnie Cassidy, maiden name Norton. Two children, Clint, 33, Coraline, 35. Because Clint is approximately the age of the late Nick Hawk, and because of his father's military record, Gottfried is keen to learn if the son volunteered with the Marine Corps, where he might have served with Nick. But Clint has no military history. He was born with talipes equinovarus, the worst kind of clubfoot. Early surgery corrected the condition, but not enough to make him soldier material. Coraline has not been in any of the services either. Egon Gottfried is patient. He is certain a connection exists between one of these people and the Hawks that will reveal where Jane's in-laws went between Killeen and Beaumont. He will find it. He likes being a loner. No chattering fools, no bolo ties. Soon, he moves on to the second name on his list, Sue Ann McMaster, the bus station clerk in Killeen. To Gottfried, the battlefield sky full of flash and flame and cannonade is not merely a storm, but also a celebration of his reinterpretation of his role. The unknown playwright is pleased. From time to time, Gottfried turns from the laptop screen to the window and stares at the weather-racked day, which seems so real, but is painted in thrilling detail just for him. Chapter 10. A hollowness in Carter Jurgen's chest, as though something has fallen out of him. The oppressive heat, The sun glare, the deep strangeness of the situation together inspiring alarm, a sense of mortal peril impending. Minette Butterworth stands tall and naked on the porch, staring not at the five people riveted by her sudden appearance, but at her hands, which she raises before her face as though bewildered to find them slick with blood. To Carter Jurgen, Radley DeBose murmurs,
"He is one lucky guy."
"Who?"
"Old Bob Butterworth, of course. The way she was dressed last night, who could know a body like that was under her clothes? Purely delicious."
Although some effort is required to look away from the goddess of death on the porch, although DeBose should long ago have ceased to have the power to astonish and appall, Jurgen stares at him in disbelief.
"You can't be serious." "My friend, when it comes to making the beast with two backs, I'm always serious."
"Where is Bob?" Jurgen suddenly wonders.
"I suspect his luck ran out."
Minette lowers her crimson hands and moves off the shaded porch, slowly descending the steps with the measured grace of a high fashion model, and even the hard desert sunshine flatters her. She stops on the walkway and at last directs her attention to those who have been transfixed by her. The younger of the deputies declares, "She's hurt," and starts forward to render assistance. DeBose seizes him by one shoulder, halts him.
"Whoa, not your jurisdiction, son. This is part of what happened at the market Sunday afternoon. This is our turf now."
"But she's hurt."
"I don't think so."
As to confirm what DeBose says, Minette Butterworth lets out a full-voiced shriek, as eerie and chilling as the cry of a coyote with blood on its breath, celebrating the rending of prey. Then from her issues a vicious stream of obscenities, braided through with hisses and guttural sounds, a rant as furious as it is incoherent. This is a female voice, but otherwise, Jurgen feels as though he's listening to Ramsay Corrigan, who slaughtered his parents, his brother, and an Arcadian who was also a Homeland Security agent. As if conjured, a phone appears in DeBose's hand. He's already into his contacts directory. With one touch, he calls the Desert Flora study group that occupies the tent and the cluster of trucks along Borrego Springs Road.
"Kill Ramsay Corrigan! Kill him now! He's transmitting psychological disintegration through the whispering room."
Minette falls silent, staring as if she expects a response. Carter draws his pistol. One of the deputies says,
"What's happening?"
Mrs. Attlee starts backing away toward her Buick. To the on-duty officer at the Desert Flora study group, DeBose says,
"Roadblocks. Fast. Every highway leaving the valley."
They have not established traditional roadblocks because, if possible, they want Jane Hawk to enter Borrego Valley by whatever deception she devises, perhaps let her feel a little cocky before closing the exits behind her. As Jurgen reminds the big man of this, DeBose cuts him off.
"It's not just about Hawk now. We injected 50 people last night."
The hollow feeling in Carter Jurgen's chest expands to his gut. His alarm escalates into fright, but he dares not succumb to fear.
"Maybe they're not all as far gone as this crazy bitch." "Maybe not. Maybe nanowebs aren't in every case facilitating the breakdown and repurposing of highly complex neural pathways, but the human brain has a high plasticity, which makes it vulnerable as hell to this. Maybe the 50 we brain screwed are in a variety of psychotic states, some of them still able to pass for normal, but none of the freaks will play nice just because we say, 'Do you see the Red Queen?' Gotta contain